Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the March 4th meeting of the Gustavus City Council. And this is our work session. At present, we have Vice Chair Brian Taylor, Council Members Taylor, Driscoll, and Jim Makoviak is on Zoom. So we will proceed with the agenda. The first item on the work session agenda is the answer coffee with council questions. And we're going to do things a little differently starting with tonight's meeting because of wanting to ensure that names are in the show up well in the recordings. We're going to ask that before you speak, just give your name. So we will start with the Madam Clerk, did you have any thoughts about how to proceed with the coffee with council question FAQs, question and answer?
I thought you could just maybe direct the conversation of going down through the questions. And then I can try to take notes or I can go back through the recording and write down the answers that the council agrees upon for the question.
Okie doke. Okay, so this is from the coffee with council meeting on January 27th, and some community members had questions, and we are going to, our goal is to have this public, this coffee with council meeting every other month, and then in the off months, we will answer questions that arise during those coffee meetings. So we're looking for council members to sign up for a meeting within the next I guess 4 or 5 months or so to kind of get it started. So we would like to have one this month if possible. So the first question was, what does it mean to annex a city into a borough? And I can start with that and then welcome other council member comments. Annexation would include a city's boundaries within a borough. The process can be done through a petition to the local boundary commission or through the legislature. And by the way, I just have to tell you that I've read this, and so I'm not entirely sure I'm absolutely accurate. So just bear with me. In the petition process, the proposed annexation would need to be approved by the annexing municipality and the area proposed to be annexed. In other words, there would be two votes in each community. In the legislative option, the local boundary commission presents the proposed boundary change to the legislature, and it becomes effective 45 days after presentation or at the end of the session, unless it's disapproved by a majority of both members of each house. And from looking at their charts, there are public hearings in both process, a lot of public opportunities to comment and review, but those are the two different ways that the annexation happens. And do, okay, Mike, you want to go ahead?
Yes, Mike. The only thing I'd add is, well, we did an annexation for the city 10 years ago when we added the hydro, the lands of the Falls Creek hydro area and the Icy Strait passage from the dock over to Pleasant Island. So we've done that once before for our city, and you do have to go through the whole petition thing. We have to, if somebody was going to say we wanted to annex to Haines or something, presumably Haines would prepare a petition, or we would do it with them, and that petition would be filed with the local boundary commission, just like HUNA has done. And you'd have to have all that justification and all that stuff, and it goes through hearings and the work. So it's a pretty big process. And but it is nice to know that both the annexing, the original borough and the annex, the area to be annexed, have to both vote in favor of it for it to be successful. So according to Jedediah Smith. So for us to be added to one of the other boroughs is not an easy thing to do. They'd have to really want to, and we'd have to really want to make it something that would happen, I think.
Okay.
Unless the legislature decided to force everybody into boroughs, that would, then there could be a legislative option approach, and we wouldn't get to vote.
Okay. But there would be a public hearing and an opportunity for us to present.
Yeah, there's still all of that, I would assume. But and we could always appeal to the legislature to turn it down. Mm-hmm. And if they take action to turn it down, then it's dead.
Okay. And question number two, anybody else want to comment? Do you want to comment?
If you don't mind, this is... Say, I'm just curious. It's kind of a shame we don't have Kyle or Rachel here, because I'd be curious to hear the context around this question, because when I first read it, it struck me as potentially a misunderstanding of what was happening with the Puna Local Boundary Commission petition and what that potentially they were trying to annex us into that borough. So I wasn't... No. I read that and wondered if that was the context in which the question had been asked. So I don't know if
I suspect it was probably... this is Shelley. It was because the question was, if not the borough, or if the borough, then will we be annexed? Will we be annexed by either the Haynesboro or the Hoonah borough?
Gotcha. Down the line, right. Our options.
Because the borough is not an annexation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, that clarifies that for me.
Okay. So the next question, how will this affect our PILT grant funds? And who could answer that? That's a good question. That's an open question. And I'll start, and hopefully others will comment too. PILT funds are allocated by a formula based on the Hoonah Angoon census area. We have contacted the state and federal PILT directors and Bureau of Land Management can't get information on what acreage we have in order to determine what impact Borough Incorporation would have on our PILT resources. And Kathy, did you have any additional comment on that?
No, I've talked to several agencies. I've talked to Jedediah Smith. He can't seem to find an answer with his folks. I think that in the original letter, even the Hoonah folks had mentioned they were trying to find that information out too and hadn't been able to. I'm beginning to wonder if there's actually a boundary divided up, or if they just take all the overall acreage and say, you get this much, you get this much, you get this much, and then that changes once there's a borough. But I feel like it's an answer we need to have, everybody needs to have, before they can move forward, or we don't know the extent of the loss of revenue that we would have.
Right. Okay. Number three, what are the pros and cons for the three main scenarios? We join the Hoonah borough, we join the Haynesboro, we start our own borough. There seemed to be consensus on pursuing options versus declining to join the Hoonah borough could be better than inevitable annexation. And I thought someone had commented that the Haynes taxes are higher than the proposed taxes in Hoonah, which is right now it's 1% seasonal. Another comment was the reduction in boundary area might allow Gustavus the potential to form a borough with the other communities, Pelican, Elvin Cove, and Tenneke Springs. So any other pros and cons? Does anyone want to comment?
I guess.
And this is Brian.
Yeah, this is Brian. Pros and cons, I think you've pretty well outlined the main ones. I would just say this, that, I mean, I guess potentially we, you know, with a long enough time frame, we eventually find ourselves as part of a borough, but it seems that this might be a little bit of a false dichotomy where, you know, there's certainly an option, which is the option that we're taking, to decline to join a borough. So just, I guess, noting that, which I'm sure was noted in the moment, actually.
Okay. And next question, where are we currently regarding the Nature Conservancy TNC land issue? Mostly strong opposition. There was strong opposition regarding a transfer. Many people agree that we should communicate and work directly with Hoonah, consider land acknowledgement and working together. My comment is that we're talking with TNC and a work group has gotten together, which Mike is going to be explaining a little later, to discuss formation of a lands committee to consider how we can share stewardship partnership with TNC or another conservation trust. Did you have anything additional you wanted to add, Mike?
You want me to just review that now then, or just Mike?
Okay. Why don't we take this up later?
Sure.
Okay, in the meeting. And Jim has, Makoviak has his hand up. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe I should make my comment later, but I think that the TNC Global Board is apparently going to meet in Gustavus in June. And I think it would help, Shelley, if you would just send an email to Ivy saying, hey, you're going to be here. We'd like to meet with you.
Okay, and, thanks, Jim. Actually, that meeting has been canceled by TNC. And I got a very nice letter from Ivy recently. I haven't circulated it yet. But yeah, the global group won't be coming to Gustavus. So, anybody? Okay. Let's see. Next question is, is there any cruise ship stake in TNC land transfer? And I don't really know what that question is asking.
Be happy to make, this is Brian, be happy to make an inference here, but it seems like the implication is that they're, you know, imagining if the Nature Conservancy were to transfer the land to the Hoonah Indian Association, eventually that would lead towards cruise ship activities or somehow cruise ships taking a stake in the land itself is what I'm guessing. And that based on what we heard in the meeting where they came and presented to us, that seems to be a non-issue or something that would take some serious finagling over a very long amount of time for the HIA to be able to, you know, move out of the conservation easements would be left on the land and everything that the Nature Conservancy would leave on the land, which they were very explicit about, not just passing off the land, but so much as, you know, making sure that whatever entity they passed it to would maintain its conservation status. So it seems highly unlikely that we'd see anything like that occur if. And yes, I guess short answer, maybe I would say no, there's no cruise ship stake or stake for any cruise ship company involved in that land transfer that we heard of at all. So,
okay, thank you. Next question. Do we have an attorney for these land issues? And our city attorney, Bob Lasko, is experienced and very knowledgeable about land issues. Also a very nice guy. Next question. Where are we at with the TSA Alaska Airlines issue? And Kathy, could you take that one?
Yeah, Kathy Leary here. So when I was in Juneau, the commissioner of public safety and DOT and the South Coast director are still working on this. They have their STIP issue as a priority, but they're supposed to be setting up a meeting shortly. The other part, though, is that the Alaska Airlines, I guess he's a liaison of sorts to cities and governments. Scott Heberstrand, I think is his name. I'm not pronouncing it exactly correctly. Was in Juneau and indicated to Melanie Lesh, he was up in the office she's working in, and he seemed to think that it was going to be resolved at the Alaska Airlines TSA issue or level. And so I haven't heard back anything yet, but they have expanded apparently their service by at least a week or more from their original schedule. And I don't think they'd be putting that out there for people to be able to buy tickets if they didn't anticipate that it was going to be resolved. So we are still working on it. We don't have anything definitive, but word on the street is it'll be fixed somehow.
I like that.
And and Senator Murkowski's office is also, I'm in touch with them, and they're also having meetings with Department of Interior people in DC. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not a done deal, but people are extremely hopeful that it's going to be working out.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy, and also for your work staying on top of the issue. Last question, I think. Second to last question. Community wants the city to have a strong stance in the current land issues and become more communicative with Hoonah itself on some of these matters. And my comment, and what I would welcome this, of course, I'm back to Shelley. I forget to give my name. We have personal and professional relationship with Hoonah residents, which I think we really treasure. But I think what we're seeing driving this is industrial tourism corporations behind the proposal to seek additional lands for development and commercial uses of our waters. So I think it's not becoming supportive and communicative, you know, with the Hoonah, the city of Hoonah and its residents. I think it's we're probably, you know, more concerned about the commercial development and And does anybody else want to comment? Oh, Kathy?
Yes. They have now until April 1st to respond to all the people who commented. And there was a lot of comments which discussed some of the ambiguities of the petition and the, how things that were missing, things that didn't align with the standards. So I think we're going to see on April 1st, that they're going to be maybe clarifying a lot of things and responding to the blowback they're getting from the petition, basically, and not the least of which is the 1% seasonal taxation issue. We may be hearing a little bit differently from them on that. So I think you'll have to wait until they get their responses into all the comments on April 1st.
Okay. And Janine?
Yes. And so I just wanted to put in a comment that on the website, I'm sure, is the response that the city has put in officially and other official responses to this. And I really appreciate that they were there for me to read, as well as that they're there for everyone. And I would suggest, if people want to see more information about how the city responded to these questions in a formal manner, that they go onto the website and look at the correspondence, because there's a wealth of information there for them.
Okay. And back to Shelley, that's the Local Boundary Commission Alaska is how I Googled it, and it'll pull it up, and you'll see that over on the right-hand side, present and past or current and past petitions, and you click on that, and it takes you back. And the first entry is the Huna petition. You click on that, and then you'll see the last I counted, I think, was like 104 responses. There were quite a number of, and very interesting and very well thought out. So did you want to, Mike?
Yeah, one thing I'd add, as I look at this question, I think there's very, this is Mike, there's very strong support in our community for the city defending the interests our community has in the lands that we depend on, and they're part of our community and are essential to our lifestyles and even our economy. And so I believe we will do everything we can do when those lands are and their uses and ownership may be threatened. That said, and I think that probably means that we're not really interested in any change of ownership that would put them under HUNA's control. That said, though, there are a lot of things that we, I think, can and should work with HUNA on, where we do have shared interests, and those might be things like fisheries issues or the Tongass Forest or subsistence things that where we may very much have common interests with them, and we should probably seek for opportunities to reach out to them for those things, but without means here, and we'll continue to manage them and work, to protect them, our interests.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And last question is, can we reach out to our state representative officials for support? And we've kept Representative Keel and Senator Story. And want to thank Kyle and Rachel very much for engaging in this conversation with the community members, and for them compiling and providing with the questions, and hopefully we can continue this process. Next on the list is the road maintenance process update, and I'll turn.
Okay. This is something that we've talked about on and off over the years, and particularly in the last couple of years, as we tried to assure that we had a road maintenance sustainable, that where we had at least one contractor who was interested in bidding it and doing the work, and is feeling that it's worth their time and effort and investment, and so that we maybe don't have to go through quite the same battle every year of wondering whether we're even going to have snowplow services, has happened several times, and we've had to rebid snow plowing or change the model to make it acceptable, you know, to attract a contractor to even do the work. And our existing contractor, who is the certainly the most equipped in town of the general contractors to do this kind of work, they're the only ones I think that have a road grader, for example, has been interested in looking at their partnership with us in for the long term and having a little more security in that they will have a decent amount of business going forward to make it worth buying better equipment or leasing it. Justin mentioned that his insurance company asked him why some of his equipment was 40 years old. and these guys do wonders with keeping them going and serving our community. But, new equipment costs money, and you have to, if you're going to borrow money for it, you have to demonstrate that you're going to get a return on investment on that for a number of years. So they've been interested in whether we might be able to do a longer period contract, say 3 years or 5 years or some such. Another aspect of this has been, as we try to manage the road maintenance, our road maintenance model we adopted from essentially the model that's used at the Fairbanks North Star Borough, where I used to work for Public Works and was on a road commission up there. And it's a model wherein you put out a bid opportunity for contractors every year, and they bid to provide set services at certain prices. And there are standards that you put out for things like grading and snow plowing and gravel additions and all of that. There are actually specs for those in our agreement. And then theoretically, the city has a point of contact engineer or whatever that is, or in the Fairbanks Borough, usually it's a member of the particular service area, and they have 105 service areas. Ours was the Chena Hills service area, and had 10 miles of road. The contact for the city or for the road service area has to determine what work needs to be done on the road and on your roads, and you order that from the contractor, and they come out and do it, and you go back and check to make sure, did they really put the gravel where we said they should, and have they graded the road properly, or if you've ordered snow plowing, did they snow plow shoulder to shoulder and all the specs on that. They submit a bill and you pay it. So we have tried to do that, but we don't have any paid staff to do that. And so that when we had a road committee, the road committee members tried to do that. In the last few years, the city administrator and I have mostly done that. We don't always look at the stuff the way that theoretically you would. And a lot of times we just trust the contractor to do the right thing anyway. And they know the roads better than any of the rest of us because they're actually out there working them. And so it occurred to us, suppose if we had an internal department, we would have all this equipment, and that department would be making the decisions on where to expend the effort. And, is it better to put gravel here or grade over there, or what's the best use of the money? And we thought, what if we treated our contractor more like it was a city department, but it's just contracted department? And they actually made the decisions based on general criteria, for road quality and so forth, such as our specs books, as to what was the best thing to do and where to do it and where to put on gravel, and without us having to go out and determine all that and follow up and check them. In other words, we trust them to do it right. and we monitor in general, is the public happy with the road service that we've got? And we would probably still be driving the roads occasionally, the city administrator or another point of contact, to in fact see are we really keeping them up, because we still have that ultimate responsibility. But we would be turning more of those decisions for routine maintenance over to the contractor. And but when it comes to projects that are sort of beyond general maintenance, or the routine maintenance, we probably would, such as doing new ditches or installing new culverts, that sort of thing, we would probably still go ahead and put those out to bid on an RFQ. And because there are other contractors who are capable of putting in culverts or ditching and that sort of thing, whereas they may not have the brush cutting equipment or the road grader and the like for that you need for the regular routine maintenance. So we could still put out to bid projects like cleaning Glenn's ditch or putting the culverts in on same old road, or ditching and culverting Wilson. Those are some projects we've got coming. Those would still be put out to bid. And we'd probably get the best value for our money by doing that. So I tried to describe how that might work in this little paper. And we just wanted to alert you that we're thinking about going this approach. And instead of putting it out to bid on an RFQ, we would probably do a request for proposal. So it's a little bit more like professional services. And they would propose how they would go about doing the service, how they would work with us, the kinds of equipment they have, what their hourly rates are on the equipment. And we might they might be billing us based on hours instead of having, instead of a set price for grading Tong Road, for example. So we would pay for greater hours that they spend doing the general work that we've asked them to do. But they would propose this, and I kind of outlined that in this paper here. So it's something I think it'd be nice if we could do this starting the next fiscal year, if we can get this together and agree that that's the approach we want to take. Snow plowing, winter maintenance would be rolled right into annual maintenance. It would all be the contractors responsible for everything. They'd have to be here, have staff here ready to respond, any day of the year. And there might even be a minimum amount that we agree to spend with them during the year. And I'd suspect that we will spend more money than we've been spending, but we will get more done. So that's kind of the approach here. And so if you got any questions or about that, I think we'll still be evolving this a little bit. And I've had some input from an outside engineer that also went over it with me. And he said that this kind of approach is now being done in other places in the lower 48. It's fairly new. State of Arizona apparently does it on a large scale for their highways. So at any rate, that's the idea. And I think we'll have to come to some decision on this. And if we're going to put it out like this for on an RFP, request for proposal, then we've got to get that together and have it all concluded by the end of this fiscal year, so it's ready to start the next fiscal year, July 1st.
Okay. I guess I've got two comments. Under the contractor duties towards the end of the paragraph, what you're saying about some projects will continue to be independently bid, put out to bid, and the language is... says that larger projects such as major road construction, multiple culvert installations and bridge repairs or construction may be subject to broader contract solicitation. I think I'd like to have that be clarified or specified that, you know, that that there will be additional contracts
in the RFQ, sure.
And then the other comment was under the contractor selection and award. And the bulleted points, two of the items have parentheses that say heavily weighted. And I would just comment that that's pretty ambiguous language. And I think all factors should be weighted if you're going to weigh two of them. And that could be done in the technical review document, in which, you know, to see whether the contractor was in compliance. I think that all items should be weighed. So, because heavily weighted doesn't say anything really, unless if you want to weight something 10 points and you want to weight something 5 points, then I think you need to specify that. I've seen this done in other contracts.
It, I wasn't trying to design it down to that detail, which we would still have to do. But the point was, as when you're selecting a professional engineer to do a job, you don't go strictly on the lowest price. There are other, you try to design a, you know, way of weighting proposals or aspects of the proposal so that you're getting the best overall value for the public. And probably the best value comes from the most experienced contractor you can get for the job that you want to do. And even if they're for example, they may have higher rates for running a grader for an hour or something like that, but they also may have a better grader, and they may know how to do it better than somebody who's brand new at it and says, well, I'm going to come over from Juneau and start a business there and do this. Well, they don't know our roads and all of that. So so the idea would be to value experience in choosing the contractor very highly.
Okay.
But, you know, if you come up with a formula with, you know, sometimes you come up with weighting that you, so many points for this and so many points for that. And frankly, it still is a little, well, not arbitrary, but it's not as objective as it appears when you put, you can put numbers on things without making them more objective. Mm-hmm. So it's, there's definitely going to be some subjective decision making in the choice of a contractor.
I just wouldn't want to exclude the potential for newcomers to have an opportunity to do services for the city.
Right, and that's one reason to keep the other kinds of projects, make more of them available for, you know, for bidding by RFQs, so they can get experience doing those kinds of things.
All right, thank you. Other, yes, Kathy?
I just wanted to say you brought the equipment into it, and you can have all the experience in the world, but if you have a better piece of equipment that's more effective and can do the job quicker, you might want to also talk about the scoring and ranking for the types of equipment available.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
You're okay. This is Brian. Just reading over this, if you don't mind, if I kind of try and summarize sort of key points to cement my understanding here. So we're kind of looking at moving towards longer road contracts, where we'll be deferring to the contractor for routine maintenance, and rather than monitoring their direct work, be monitoring public satisfaction a little bit more than that. And then we'd be looking at an RFP process versus an RFQ process. So them giving more detail and potentially proposing hourly rates instead of like per street rates. Overall, more likely we'll have a higher cost, but better service. So that's kind of key points. And first, I guess I should say thank you for your work on this. This is really nice to lay that out. So that's kind of what I'm taking and understanding from this. And I definitely support that direction. I guess my question is, do you anticipate with this new model that we'll get more than one person that puts in, or more than one contractor that puts in a proposal? Because I know we're already having issues with getting people to submit quotes for our work already.
I think it's, you know, in the past several years, all we've got is one contractor. Mm-hmm. Been a long time, way back, Fairweather Construction had it before Elm owned it, when Eric Lockman had it. He did it for about a year or so. But for the last several years, we've only had one bidder anyway. We would probably have a local bidder preference in here also. Mm-hmm. So right now, there's really only one contractor that has the capability of doing all the things. Yeah, now, we have other contractors who are perfectly good at doing some things, but they don't have the they don't have the equipment or the maybe even enough staff. And this might allow the contractor to put on some more employees or another employee to run, you know, a piece of equipment or two. So we give them a little bit more assurance that they've got the business and that they're going to have it for, you know, for a good period of time. And so it's worth investing more in it.
Yeah, I can definitely
see.
We
hope it will work. But if it doesn't seem to be working, we can, there would be a contract in there that, I mean, a clause in there for a termination. And either because the contractor doesn't find it works for them or we find it doesn't work for us, this thing's got to work for both sides.
Yeah.
And we're fortunate that all of the contractors that we have here in Gustavus are people we trust and have good relationships with, and they do good work and they treat the city well and the public well and care about the public. So we're lucky about that. Not every community has that kind of contracting contractors available. And a lot of communities spend an awful lot of time in the courts, you know, in legal fights with their contractors. We've never had to do that.
Understood. So I guess I was mostly just curious if you thought that this would potentially make the bidding or proposal process more competitive. And it sounds like that's not necessarily the primary focus in what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Awesome.
And this is Shelley. Oh, just one more thought we've had is that we've kind of been doing a lot of kind of piecemeal repairs as we go along. So I think possibly it's my understanding that the goal is that we try to be a little bit more proactive and start doing regular maintenance and regular upkeep with the culverts and all. Is that correct, Mike? Would you say, would you agree?
Well, one thing that we've talked about doing for some time is having a consultant look at our whole road system. Somebody's really good on gravel roads and help us prioritize things and identify opportunities that we and the contractor haven't thought of before, or approaches that we haven't taken before, and then prioritize things system-wide a little better. But I also think that the iterative approach on making improvements, small improvements, can be really effective. And by that approach, and this is a Strong Towns idea, for those of you who know about the Strong Towns organization, you go out and find, you know, you listen to the public, you know, what are they saying their needs are, and you find what's the next small project that we can do and get it done and fix. And you do that one, and then that one's done, and you move on to the next little one. And that iterative approach helps you stay up better with, you know, in a city, you're fixing the broken sidewalks or the traffic light that's out or the bus stop that's broken, that kind of thing. And you work on those things, and they're little things that can come up at any time. But if you keep working those little things, you've got you make a big difference across your whole community. And so I'd say there's a combination to looking at it globally and prioritizing, but being, you know, ready to fix the little thing that you find that needs to be done and that will make it better for the people, say, in that neighborhood.
And this is Shelley. Thank you, Mike. And Janine, did you have a question?
So I think you touched on it a little bit there in terms of the iterative approach. But one of the things I see, if it's a long-term contract, well, then is there also going to be then steps to be making a long-term plan? And in terms of, so will we have a vision for what we want the roads to be like, and the goal of what we, you know, we hope. The roads are a huge problem, as we all know, and we put so much time and energy into fixing them on the short term, but do we also want to have a long-term plan of where we want to go? And I was hoping that they'd be part of that, developing that program or that plan.
Sure, right. And that's part of what, when I mentioned the possibility even of using a consultant to help us look at the system more globally. So yeah, I'd say yes. Maybe we can do a better job of that under this model, I would hope.
And then one thing, another question I had was about the oversight by the city. And so does this, how much does this change what city people are doing? What does this help in terms of, or how does it change in terms of any hours by the city manager? You know, where does that play?
Theoretically, if you're not having to go out and determine, look at all, drive all the roads all the time and determine what needs to be graded or plowed or whether we need to have gravel, that's time that we don't have to spend doing that because the contractor would be charged with inspecting roads on a regular basis. That'd be part of their job. And so that could save us time. Save the city administrator time. If we ever have a city engineer, the city engineer wouldn't have to be doing that. The city engineer could instead be designing the next bigger project, the new culverts or the ditches or the bridge repair or that sort of thing. So we would maybe have make better use of our time, I think. Bet Kathy's got a good point on that view on this.
Well, it just came in late today. When I was in Juneau at the Alaska Municipal League Winter Legislative Conference, I met, well, actually it was the week before, but I met with a woman from HDR, and they're a national organization that they don't only do grants, they do project planning, they have engineers, they have experts in their field, and a lot of those folks are transportation planners and engineers. So I got a proposal from her. I went over all of the grants we currently have out, all of the projects we've had scoping documents for, or most of them. I told her where we are wanting to look at an area-wide roads planning scenario, but we would have to start with a planning grant before we started with what we were going to do. Anyway, so she just gave me a proposal for them to review our CIP and for them to help us prioritize them and meet with council and staff and other folks. And I mean, we've just gotten to the point where it's just too big for any one person or one council person to handle. And so getting help in prioritizing our needs and having people that are on the lookout that specialize looking for the grants that we're looking for and can direct us to those. Now, this proposal isn't to write grants. This proposal is to evaluate all of our needs, help us prioritize them and direct us to the funding. And then if we want them to help with grants, then they will use their experts in those fields for those grants. So they don't have to go like do research because they already have experts in-house. And they've brought in billions and the state DOT is using them. So I think they're pretty well known and have good success rates. So I just, like I said, I just got this tonight. I'm hoping to present it with an NCO next week. Or it's probably going to be about $7,000 or $8,000 for them to do this for us. But I feel like they've got the people and the know-how, and it won't be so fragmented. Like I can handle four or five or six things, but we got 25 things on our plate. So I really think we need some professional help to get it all encapsulated and looked at in a more overarching overview and with a plan we can follow that's not just a CIP plan, but they can tell us how to get funds for it. So that's cool. What I had.
The
CIP review from HDR. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I'll put that in the packet for next Wednesday. But I just got it hot off the press, so you can give copies down that way if you want.
Cool.
Thank you, Kathy. Okay. No other comment. We'll move on. Thank you. The next item on the work session agenda is review City Council attendance ordinance for update. And I think this has been, the timing of this has come about because the city clerk is going to be giving her quarterly report next month and does a review of attendance as part of that report. Am I correct? Okay.
Yeah, so this is Liesl, the city clerk. So I have to monitor the attendance and gearing up for the next meeting, I noticed that we have some folks that are kind of coming on to the, like, verging on the edge of what our ordinance says. But when I did a deeper dive in the ordinance, I don't think the ordinance really properly reflects our current time in this world with Zoom and it talks about teleconferencing. And so I think that it would be wise for the council just to look over the entire ordinance as a whole for it and think about what the city council attendance, what it should look like for the future. I think ideally it'd be great to have whatever we want the ordinance to look like, whatever you guys want it to look like rather, in time for passing by August. So that way, when we have new seats opening up for the next election, those council members know what's coming. So that way, when they put in file for candidacy, there's no surprises. So it's just one of those things that I think we need to update to reflect current times.
Okay, thank you, Liesl. And this is Shelley. I think, yeah, we've got three separate ordinance codes, which are in your packets. And it looks like one of them, the middle one, 2.30.040 City Council Member Attendance Policy for Regular Meetings. I know there's been some discussion about how there was sort of a policy was sort of adopted into ordinance. And so I think we could kind of clean this up. I was looking at the Zoom statistics, and we had three people with between 75% and 80% Zoom attendance. So I'm thinking that then that falls under the telephonic participation ordinance, which is a bit archaic. But I would like to reserve Zoom attendance for the public and move back to being present in council chambers. And I know that there are reasons why some people are going to be out of the country, and perhaps we can grandmother in those folks. But it's time that we because the Zoom participation, while welcome, it really is not not very active and not very participatory. So that's my thought about that. And we look forward to maybe I don't know whether we want to reorganize these sections of the code into one ordinance or two or whatever, but we'll be looking at that and starting to. And any other thoughts and communications on this issue? And Brian?
Yeah, reading over this, definitely agree the use of modernization. It strikes me that, I guess I'm torn because on the one hand, I agree that Zoom participation is certainly not to the same level as what we see when we have everyone here in the room. We definitely get our most robust discussion and kind of the quickest work done when everyone is here in person. And that's certainly the ideal that I think we should strive for. But I do worry about the chilling effect we might see by adding more reservations or restrictions on attending via Zoom, particularly from a younger demographic that we already have a little bit of trouble attracting into these positions when they already have careers. And I guess speaking for myself, which is all I can really do here, that's something that would make me pretty quickly consider not continuing next year, just based on how much I'm traveling for work and try and be out of the city for at least 2 months in winter, just for sanity purposes, visiting family, etc. So it definitely makes it would be pretty averse to restricting Zoom too heavy-handedly, but I think we could definitely. I don't think that's a total. I guess I don't think we're completely opposed on how we want to move forward with this, but I would be wary of drawing too firm of a line on, you know, Zoom period is over now, I guess, essentially.
And this is Shelley. Part of it too is that an awful lot of work ends up on very few shoulders here in town. And we've started to kind of pick up on that. Janine has been working and Jim Mack has done work on resolutions. If we had people, even if they're out of town and attending by Zoom, that were actively participating in the projects and the work of keeping the council running, that would be immensely helpful. But other than just, you know, kind of sitting in and listening in on Zoom, we need a little more active involvement, and maybe we could consolidate that with occasional Zoom attendance. Okay, go ahead, Janine.
So I have several thoughts on this, and one is that I think that you're looking at a couple different things as you're presenting this as saying the problem is the Zoom attendance, and I don't see it that way. I think that we need to, as a council, figure out a way to communicate what's needed to be done, other than because it's difficult to have any input when you start out by, we've got this proposal and you say, well, this is how it should be done, that we should not do Zoom meetings when we've had no discussion. And I think that's part of the issue, is that in the council, I don't feel as a council member that the discussion periods happen, and I don't know whether it's because of the open meeting law that we can't talk amongst ourselves other than during the work sessions, but I don't really feel like I'm a council, even when it's because it doesn't seem that there's a lot of input requested until the meeting happens, when we get these pieces of paper that say this is what it's going to be like. And so when I saw this written here without any change to it, I thought, great, this will be a good time for us to have a conversation about it. But I'm not hearing a request even for a conversation about it. You started by saying, well, we're going to get rid of Zoom. And I'm sitting here going, I think before we can even start to write what we want this proposal to look like, we should open the floor to real genuine discussion. And by getting genuine discussion, then people feel like they have a reason to buy into helping. But until that happens, it's really hard to do that.
I was giving, this is Shelley, giving my feeling about this. You know, sometimes we've got two people here, maybe three people. And also in the Open Meetings Act, three is free. So three council members can join in. We've had work groups. We could have telephonic work groups. It's part of it is my concern that Zoom has been ineffective. It's been an ineffective way of managing the work that needs to be done and communicating. And the other is that council members aren't coming forward with projects. I don't know. I've started asking people if they would do things, and that's been accepted. But this, I'm starting the dialogue now. I want to talk about it because I'm saying, you know, Mike and I have been here doing a huge amount of work, and sometimes there's just nobody around, and I want to fix that.
And so, I mean, I agree that there's issues with Zoom, but I don't think that the whole issue is the Zoom. I think that there's other issues, or there's ways that Zoom could be more effective than it is now. And I mean, I feel very strongly that we should not be limiting what the putting more restrictions on council members. When I ran, it was the day that the, you know, people had to put in to run for city council, and there was two seats and there were no candidates. And so I put in my candidacy on the very last day, knowing that, okay, I can do this because I can participate via Zoom. Had that not been an option, I wouldn't have put in my candidacy. And then it did end up that on that very last day, there were other, there was a candidate for each one of the seats that got, you know, also put in. Although as you ran on a write-in. And so we, it's not like we've got a lot of people raising their hands saying, I want to be on city council. And I think what we need to do is make this enter into, you know, the century that we're in. And the reality is that Zoom and virtual communication is the way people act. But I just think we need to be better at it. I mean, I don't think that it's throw it away. I think we need to go and have a conversation about how is this going to be, how do we move forward with this as an option? And I see that it has negatives. I mean, and I feel I can communicate more when I'm here and I try to be here when I'm here. But I think that we really want to like figure out how can we make this work for us? How can it make it work better as opposed to saying Zoom is the problem? I think that Zoom is one of the answers actually, but we just need to be able to do it better is what I'm thinking.
Mike?
I share Shelley's view on this, and I have for quite a long time. Years, you know, I've been on the council for a long time, going way back to when we did have a phone that, you know, was that a council member could call in on, and I think we could have one or two people on that, and that was the maximum. People were allowed to miss a couple of meetings, you know, particularly, and obviously if they're sick or have a sick child, that's reason to stay home and participate by Zoom. But I strongly feel that council members are a lot more effective when they're here in the room at the table and we're looking at each other, we're looking at the expressions on our faces and body language and all of that. I think people are more effective if they're here at the table and participating more actively that way. We tend to forget sometimes that there's somebody on Zoom. And also, somebody commented the other day that who has observed our meetings by Zoom, and I don't remember who it was, but said, when you look at, you're watching the meeting on Zoom and there are only three council members at the table, it doesn't look good for the council that people are missing, even if they're on Zoom, even if they're participating on Zoom from elsewhere, we make a much stronger impression. And I think we work more effectively if we're all here in the room. And I say that, though, knowing that, in fact, in the past, we had times when we couldn't even maintain a full council. Sometimes we were down to five. Once we almost went to four. And we did go to four once. Some of that is due to the people not always wanting to come to meetings and feeling they just couldn't do it, and they might have continued to be on the council if they had had Zoom available. So the point that you guys are making is certainly valid. The only thing I can suggest is, we could tighten it up a lot. If people are in town, I think they should be at the table here, and unless they're sick or something like that. And we could have a certain number of meetings that are allowable as, to be done by Zoom or to be totally missed with excuses. But I think the more that we can be here at the table, the better job we'll do for the public. It's just my view after all these years.
So, I mean, I think that there's a compromise within this, and I agree with you saying we don't even know necessarily who's on Zoom. But I don't think that that's a problem with Zoom. I think that's a problem with our screen, or maybe we could reconfigure how we do. In most of the time when I'm on a Zoom meeting, and I do Zoom meetings with weavers across the country, and we do all kinds of interactive things, and you're sitting there looking at a screen, and you see everyone's face who is participating, and so you know who's all there. The way that we've chosen to present the Zoom screen doesn't allow for that. And so I'm thinking that we have a lot of potential to sit and really problem solve how could we make this better, as opposed to throwing it away. because I do think that there are legitimate times where people would have reasons to be participating on Zoom, and that we can make it a lot better. If we had two screens and we had, in fact, I can't read. I mean, I don't know who's reading the thing that's written up there, because I have pretty good vision, but I can't read that. I have to read it off of my computer screen. And we all have our computer screens open because we can't read that. The people who are here in the audience, they're not looking at the screen because it's the chairs aren't even facing that way. And so my suggestion is that we have a screen that shows the people's faces, and that we have perhaps the people, you know, the city council members are faces in one spot, and then maybe in a smaller thing, or maybe they have who the audience is. That there's got to be a way then to make Zoom be more interactive. That is how it is in every other Zoom venue I've participated in, but this one, it's not like that. And so I agree that there's lots of things that we can do better in terms of participation, but I'm really reluctant to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that one of the big things that COVID did in a positive way for this country is, and the world, is connecting people via Zoom. And it's a tool, and a tool can be used in lots of different ways. And maybe what we need to say is, how can we be using this tool better? And maybe we can be tweaking some other changes as well. And I'm certainly open for, you know, brainstorming and talking about how we want to see this and what our vision is. But I think we need to look at, how can this tool be more helpful to us than the way we've been using it now?
Okay, Brian.
I think a lot of what we're saying, there's really good room for compromise among us on all of this. I think that it's more than reasonable to allow people to continue participating remotely. I say that as someone who does literally his entire career job remotely. There is no office for my job, and we're a multi-billion-dollar company, so it can be done. Although we don't have to contend with the Open Meetings Act, and so there are some facets that make that a little bit more difficult. So I think that what Janine is saying about improving our use of the tools is certainly possible. On the other end, I likewise agree that if you're in town, you probably should be here, and that we do get a more rich communication when we have each other right here and you can see the body language. So I think that maybe there's a middle ground where we say, you know, a certain number of remote participations per year, you know, it's not quite an absence, but that is also counted. If I think about my life, it's rare to have a year where I'm not in town more than, I guess I would say, 3 months. So speaking just for my personal, you know, what I would shoot for my own personal needs, if I could attend, you know, that would be maybe 6 meetings remotely, maybe 8 meetings remotely a year. I guess I don't know how many meetings we have in a year. That might be, but a certain number of meetings, you know, within reason remotely, then that would more than meet my needs for being able to continue to live my life in the way that I do, which is largely itinerant and seasonal, and still being able to participate. I think that also we could definitely do better as far as just on the council engagement while people are not in town, about proactively communicating when we have needs. I should apologize for not being more engaged while I was gone these past few months when we were dealing with all of these issues, and not proactively reaching out to you to say, is there a way that I can help? But I guess my expectation in those moments was, if I am needed, I will be called upon. And it can be a little bit daunting coming on as a council member to try and understand where there's a need for us. So I think that there's certainly room for us to improve that kind of aspect of council participation, because it's just as possible for people to show up to the meeting here in person and listen to the meeting and then, you know, tip their hat as they walk out the door and not participate in any projects as well. So that, I think that what Janine's saying, you know, about using the tools better and also finding better ways to foster engagement and maybe being a little bit less nervous about the Open Meetings Act, at least as far as, you know, embracing 3 is free and being happy to lean on things that way.
Okay. Shelley, yeah, I like that. Maybe what we need to do is then, I mean, either if we don't have the people to do the work, then we will scale back on what we do, which we don't want to do because we really like what we're doing. And I think we're doing a good job. So, and thanks to Jim also for doing some resolutions for us tonight.
Yeah, I just want to say, and I think we all appreciate everybody on the council, whether they're sometimes having to participate from far away, I'm grateful for everybody that is serving and realize that not everybody is retired like I am. So you don't have quite the time. And that is, you know, is certainly understood and appreciated.
And I guess it's up to us too, if we to kind of identify where there are needs, you know, where we want some research or want, you know, a resolution or a scoping document or whatever. So good. Well, I think this is a good discussion. Any more comment?
I'll Brian. This is something that Kathy and I very briefly have investigated at one point. I'm not sure, I guess probably about a year ago. Just for you to note, as you're kind of thinking of things that we could drive improvements around this kind of engagement, specifically around remote engagement, is based on how we host. I think we host our own server here. We have network infrastructure here that ought to allow us to make it so the council members can access our digital file systems from their computer, wherever that computer may be, without having to actually be in the room. And that's something that would make, say, you know, I'm in Taiwan, but you need a scoping document drawn up. I don't have to, you know, email Liesl, ask her to send me the template. I could just open the file system because I'm logged in and authenticated and just grab it. So little things like that that we're not currently implementing and ought to be more than possible for us to implement. So hopefully, I mean, that in theory should just be, you know, call our technical consultant or our contractor and have them help get that set up. So think there are things like that. That's another one that just jumped to mind for me.
And Shelley, I just wanted to respond to Janine. I think the reason why we don't have the faces on Zoom is because of bandwidth. We've had to turn off, you know, the video cameras on people's faces, and maybe it's changed. I don't know. But Kathy, I think you wanted to.
Well, a couple of things. It should be changed, and we should be able to ask Byte to come and look at the ability to do that. It's just when they're having problems that it becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is sometimes we have issues depending on where the person is zooming in from. Like, you've been on two meetings where you come in completely garbled.
Is that
from where you're zooming from? And it's really hard to hear we couldn't hear what you were saying a few times. Like when you went to speak, we'd hear two sentences and then three of them would sound like they were underwater.
I understand that and appreciate that. I just know I've been on Zoom call things throughout the whole time I was traveling, and that never happened. And so I don't know what end it is on, so I apologize for that. I mean, I really certainly wouldn't want that to be the case, but I don't know whether it's our end or what, because I Zoomed a lot while I was gone, and I never had that issue.
Wasn't happening to anybody else. So I'm just pointing that out, that that's been an issue in understanding what you're trying to convey.
So perhaps it could be then that if we knew we were going to be Zooming, we could be given even just the microphone that would allow it to do better. Because what I think is maybe I didn't have the best microphone, and that perhaps that could be part of the way of making the tools better. That if you knew you were going to be on Zoom for a certain amount of times, there was a headphone or a microphone set we could borrow that worked with the computer.
Well, and then finally, I think we have to go out to bid again this year. You know, we're allowed to continue contracts after they're awarded for a couple of years. You can do a continuation, but there's a point at which, unless the council approves it, I think we have to go out to bid again for our new technical support contract. And we also got the cybersecurity grant for them to do just an overview on our systems to make recommendations on what we can do. And they will be looking at Alaska Technical Solutions and our systems. So maybe, and that's where you could help. Just saying. maybe put something together in the RFP that we might have to put out that would include those very things that you're talking about. So I'm just putting those few things out there for information purposes. However you guys come up with what you want to do is whatever it is, but those are the sort of the technical aspects from our perspective.
Yeah. Understood. This is Brian here. Just speaking to the issue of garbled connections, I think that it wouldn't be a bad idea to include, I don't know if this needs to be in code or in policy, but some kind of reference for potential council members to, you know that these are the specs for what we would expect your connection to look like so that you can actively or successfully participate in this kind of connection if we're going to do something like that. So that's another thing where we could potentially provide more clarity, whether that's, on how good of a connection you're going to need or not doing this on a mobile connection with a certain number of bars or whatever, however we decide to define that. That's probably something worth having. I know for my job, when I very first got it, I had to rent a place in Juneau because the internet in Gustavus wasn't good enough then. And I worked from Juneau for a number of months because my network connection here didn't meet the minimum requirements. So that's worth considering too.
Actually, thanks to Liesl, she's suggested that we could recommend the general meeting to referring this issue to committee, but I think we could also have a work group. Would you be willing to participate in a work group?
Yeah,
certainly. Okay, maybe come up with a technical or what we need to find out, about like technical specifications. And good, maybe we can do that before you head out again.
Yeah, I should be here for a while this time.
Okay, so Brian and Janine, would you be willing to participate in the work group?
Sure.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. All right. Okay, that was a good good discussion. Next up is the, review the draft general meeting agenda and packet. And the agenda is page 8 of the packet. We have the reading review of the minutes. I'm assuming that if there are any questions or concerns, you raise them now, but we'll bring them up at the general meeting. There'll be 4 reports. Library Quarterly Report, Gustavus Visitors Association Quarterly Report, City Treasurer Monthly Report, and City Administrator Monthly Report. Public comment on non-agenda items. I guess I just wanted to mention and congratulate Leah Oaken McGowan for assuming the position of permanent EMS.
Coordinator,
thank you. Yeah, so congratulations to Leah and welcome aboard. We're really glad. She's been in a temporary position for the last couple of months, and we were able to bring her on permanently, and we're really excited to have her. Okay, so there are no items on the consent agenda. The first ordinance for public hearing will be FY2411 NCO, Returning Unused Capital Project Funds. It was introduced at the February 20th, 2024 meeting. And I wonder if Ben could come and give us a brief overview of what this item is. And it looks like he's looking through his paperwork. Thanks, Kathy. I'm sorry, Ben.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Shelly, could you just repeat the...
See if I can find it for you. I've got a copy here. It's the CY24, -11 NCO, Returning Unused Capital Project Funds, introduced February 20th, 24.
Okay. Right. So this is NCO. We closed out 3 capital projects, and I had moved funds into the current account. I thought I was moving money from the Good River Bridge capital project, but actually that money wasn't there. It was a negative. So 3 capital projects were closed. We're moving that money back into long term from current, per the policy, and we're moving the $3,400 and something dollars that I put in there by mistake into the long term as well.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
Can I have a quick question on this?
Okay, Brian.
So when you see these capital projects closed, I'd really be interested, and I imagine this is something you already you have or could make available, but I'd really be interested to see at the end of these capital projects how much money is left over at the end of them. I don't necessarily know if that level of detail fits or makes sense on the NCO, but just for partly for my better understanding of how much or little is left over at the end of projects, so I can kind of have a better barometer for what maybe to expect for future projects when we're kind of allocating funds, that cushion that we like to have in there. I guess mostly is out of curiosity, but yeah, for that as well, I would be really interested to see kind of a more detailed breakdown if that's something that I don't know if it necessarily needs to be included in the packet, but or if I can just even email you when I see one of these come up and get details on, you know, what projects were closed out and how much money was left in each one. That would be awesome.
So that information is available in the packet. I'm not sure if it's available here because I haven't given Liesl the financial documents yet. Usually that comes after the first of the month, and with the first of the month happening on the weekend, I wasn't able to get that information to her before this meeting, but I will send you an email showing you where you could find that normally in the packet in the financial documents that I provide.
Thank you, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And the next item is a resolution by the City of Gustavus supporting but recommending amendment of HB 365 to extend power cost equalization credits to schools. And can anyone explain this better than me? I'll make a stab at it unless Mike or Kathy wants to pick it up.
I can try.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
I wrote the resolution. Unless Kathy, did you want to?
Well, I can do it in a nutshell, I guess. I mean, they put forth a bill asking to give schools up to 750 kilowatt hours of the PCE, which is what schools used to get way back in the day. And then they lowered it to 400 or 450. They took out businesses and schools. Now they're finding that they'd like to add it back in again. But we enjoy, as a community, a certain amount of kilowatt hours per capita that multiplied out should fall under getting this PCE subsidy, and we don't come close to using it. So the suggestion is to change the bill language to communities where they're not utilizing all of the full community PCE allotment to allow the schools to claim the difference per month that we're not claiming in our use. And of course, we would take priority over that, but at the end of the day, it would give the school here a whole lot more than 750 kilowatts per month that would be subsidized. So I don't know that it's going to change, because there'll probably be a lot of fiscal folks in the legislature who don't want to see that much come out of the funds for the PCE fund, but we're putting forward something that we would hope would help the school out with, because we do have such high rates to begin with. And 750 kilowatts isn't a whole lot for the school to get subsidized under. So that's what this resolution does. I don't know if you have anything to add, but that's in a nutshell what it's for.
Thank you, Kathy. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, this is Mike. I could add just a little bit. As I understand it, schools don't get any PCE now under the current regs, because they are theoretically they're funded by the state. And so they've been paying the full rate on their electric rates. And our community gets 70, we're credited with 70 kilowatt hours per month times the number of residents in the community for total community facility PCE. And that can go to not just to the city's buildings, but to the community center and a few other things like that. Maybe the clinic, I don't know for sure. But we have a lot of extra credit available that we're not using. And the bill, addressing this was something that actually started with Jason Custer when he observed that we weren't using all this PCE that in our community. And a year or two ago, he wrote a paper identifying that as an issue and saying that schools ought to be able to use PCE. And at the time, the utilities at the meeting that he presented that paper didn't really catch on to it. They weren't excited about it, and he thought nothing had happened. And then the bill showed up, and in the bill, all they did was add schools as the kind of facility that would qualify for the 750 kilowatt hours of PCE credit per month. But as he noted, that's helpful for schools. It does give them something, but it's a drop in the bucket for many schools. And there's still an awful lot of unused credited, PCE credit in communities that nobody's using. And so he suggested that the schools ought to just get the balance, up to their total bill of PCE. So they would like, just like city here, we get PCE for all of our electric hours, kilowatt hours. They would also. And so we're recommending that amendment to the bill to broaden the amount of kilowatt hours that schools would get.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Any other comments? This is Shelley. The next item is a resolution by the City of Gustavus supporting the continuation of the current Alaska Marine Highway Systems Advisory Operations Board. And I think we have Jim to thank for the drafting on this. Yes. And I would point out that we've also received a resolution from the City of Pelican. They took a slightly different approach there. Requesting that the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board recognize the value of matching Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act for purposes of infrastructure investment in the, I think I'm not really characterizing it very well, but anyway, to support the Alaska Marine Highway System. This particular resolution is because the governor has recently proposed an executive order 131 that would allow the governor to appoint the entire board, arguing that a board is more aligned would be able to quickly get things done. This executive order 131 would remove the or would appoint public members by the governor rather than have them be designated by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and looks like other members, the President of the Senate, as applicable. So it's to support the existing board and the diversity of the current board. Okay, anybody else want to talk about it?
Jim, want to say something about it?
Jim,
since you wrote it.
Jim, did you want to comment further? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Jim. Yeah, I worked with Senator Keel's office on writing this. They gave me some information to go with. But this will be voted on the 12th, and our meeting will be on the 11th. So we're in good time here.
Okay, thank you, Jim. And maybe could you speak to the next resolution as well? I think this is also when you drafted. Resolution by the City of Gustavus regarding the updating of the U.S. Forest Service's Tongass Land Management Plan.
Well, the resolution kind of speaks for itself, but it hasn't been, the plan hasn't been updated since 1997. Mm-hmm. It's behind schedule. And whenever they update a plan, there's potential for good things to happen. There's potential for bad things to happen. And we're looking at some things that we thought would be good. For instance, keeping the old growth forest in intact and things like that.
Okay.
The roadless rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, et cetera. It looks like to continue implementing as 2012 planning rule, conserving efforts to conserve mature and old growth forests and urging the Forest Service to maintain the 2001 roadless rule in the Tongass National Forest. Are there any other council comments or questions? Okay, thank you, Jim. Let's see, what do we have next? And this is, it will be the approval of a CIP project development form for purchasing a Lucas chest compression device. And Saul, did you, Chief Saul, want to talk to this? It's just basically just a brief synopsis of what it's about.
Kind of get a little bit of background, because this, back in 2022, the council did approve to apply for a grant to purchase it. We got some of it, not all of it. So we got $7,000 of the $25,000, rounding up, for the purchase. What basically a Lucas chest compression device is, it takes place of human compressions in a CPR event, and it's something that, like, we'll be glad to have, but hope we don't use. But I'm not naive. We're probably going to end up using CPR in some time in the future. It's just the basis of our job. Ultimately, in the last multiple studies have shown that it has improving cut rates of resuscitation of people who have fallen down at cardiac arrest. Ultimately, this is what hope this project do is allows me to go for grants, apply for grants to fund it, unless the council decides like this is something that you want to fund for us to purchase. It is the option, an option in here. Other than that, that's really it. It will help reduce the the need of amount of volunteers we need in each event. A lot of it is in compressions. If anyone has taken a CPR class, you realize how strenuous 2 minutes of compressions is, and we try to cycle people through. There was a study done in Seattle stating that after 2 minutes of CPR, they're not able to administer adequate compressions after that. And that's a department that does it nearly every day. And they have fitness requirements and stuff like that. Now imagine, yours as volunteers, you have other jobs that you don't necessarily do with fitness requirement, try to do that here. So generally what this will do is not only allow reduction of that, but also allow us to move the patient to a more suitable environment, and if we are able to get to higher level care, so get to clinic, get to a medevac, able to move the person essentially without interrupting compressions. Because the one benefit of thing that you don't want to do is interrupt compressions, and that will raise the rate, the chances of a person coming back, essentially. It's to that end, essentially, to get better rate compressions. We can, because right now we don't have the ability to move easily. We all do compressions at the same time.
Okay, thank you, yeah. Saul. Go ahead, Mike.
It's my understanding, am I correct, that our medical advisor, Dr. Vaught, has agreed with you on this and recommends it and said he'd sign the grant?
He did, yeah. In the Code Blue grant, he did sign off on it and approved it for that Code Blue grant. I have sent them this Code Blue document. I haven't, to be openly, I haven't heard anything from him about it on this particular, but he has signed in the past.
Yeah, I'm aware that he supports you on this.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that was everybody was aware of that.
All right.
Okay.
Yes, Kathy.
It's just also to be in compliance with the fact that it's $15,001 or more to put the scoping document in for the grant request, because we didn't really know it was going to be that much. And we raised the threshold, as you know, last year or right after I started here. And so this is a big enough grant that it needs to have approval.
Okay, so thank you. Okay, and next up is the... go ahead, Brian.
You're right. This is Brian. I'm curious. So I know we have $7,000 that we can put towards this that we have until 2028 to spend. Do we have any other grants on the radar that we're eyeing for this? I see.
Yeah, so it is in the scoping document, and on the funding options, there is Brothers Helping Brothers. The only thing is that on their website, we had never applied for it before, so I don't know the outcome of that. I know we have sent some information to USDA, although we have had communication issues with them in the past, so I'm not too hopeful of that. And even now I don't think we haven't got word from them since then. So right now I'm hoping to apply for Brothers Helping Brothers, and hopefully that will help. And also hopefully be keeping other eyes on other grants as well.
Awesome. Thanks for redirecting my attention to that.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Mike, the next item is to approve the CIP project development form for heat pump installations for city buildings. Could we have just a short synopsis?
Sure. We first did a scoping document on this a couple of years ago, and because we had a grant opportunity that would allow us to buy 5 or 6 heat pump systems and have them all covered by a grant. But at the time, the council thought, well, we don't know much about these heat pumps, and we'd like to just do one in City Hall first and see how that goes. So we've done that. I think it remains worthwhile to consider them. We already are considering them. It's in the chief's plan for the fire hall. And I've got that listed on here as one of the possibilities, even though we may address it separately in a different project for the fire hall. There is also the DRC office, the old post office building, and the community chest, which could use heat pumps to provide the primary source of heat in those facilities. So this would allow us to develop a project and also to see if we get another good alternative energy conservation grant that might pay for all of them. This just allows us to develop the project. So that's the idea of it.
Thank you, Mike.
And put it on again, the CIP list.
Yeah, and again, because it's over $15,000, we need to put it on the project list. Get it approved on the project list. Is that correct, Kathy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would need to go on there. The one thing I noticed, though, which I'm not sure about, is we weren't eligible for the reimbursement for this system because it was given to us. So I'm not sure if we had a grant, if we would also not be eligible. So that's just a consideration, unless we could prove that we paid for it out of some of our own funds.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. There is the $500 credit there, or not credit, $500 incentive that we get from AP&T for every building that we put one of these in. So we filed for this one and they said, well, you know, you got that one for free. And besides that, they were instrumental in getting it for us for free. So we decided to just kind of let that one drop. Jason has told me that we would qualify for the rest of these. Even if we get it paid for with a grant, I think it would still be covered. But
okay, and we
looks
have
like Janine had a question.
Go ahead, Janine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for pointing that out. And so one thing I'm just going to suggest, Shelley, is that I do feel you're quick to go to the next item before looking to even see whether there's a hand up or someone wanting to say something.
I've been looking.
You didn't look at me. I've been sitting here. And so this is the second thing that you've just gone right on without asking if there was any comments.
Jeanine, what would you like to say?
So I have a comment I would like to say, and I would like to be acknowledged when I want to say something. And so I have a couple of questions on this. I think that the heat pumps, I'm all in favor of them. And I realize that we put this Mr. Cool one in kind of as a test model. And I'm wondering if we have any data or information that would be helpful in making decisions. So that's one thing I'm wondering. I know that Sol has talked about the heat pumps for the fire hall, and he has some another option of the ones that are not Mr. Cool, but other brands that are put in by other, by Mark Berry. And how does this supplement that? Does it take it over? And then one other thing is that I remember you making a comment on the last one, how you thought that before putting in a heat system to the fire hall, it would be needed to have an engineer look at it and design and make sure that it was the right system. And I'm wondering if that goes for these as well, or if that's different, or what your thoughts are on that.
Well, those are good questions.
Mike.
Mike, get the mic back on. Yeah, hey, this is Mike with his mic on. First off, with regard to data on this one, I've come in a number of mornings, including this morning, to when we had very cold weather, to see how the equipment was running and what the temperatures were in here. This morning at 7:15 or 7:20 when I got here, it was 5 degrees outside. Weather was clear. There was no wind, which is good. I came in here and measured temperatures throughout here, and it was pretty much 64 to 65 or so. Although if you measure down on the floor, like under Ben's desk or Kathy's desk, it'll be down around 60 or something, that you get some stratification, and particularly when air doesn't circulate down under, near the floor. And this morning, the units were blowing warm air out. Actually, the air was coming out of this one at about 92 to 94 degrees, despite it only being 5 degrees outside. And to me, it was very comfortable in here. Now, that doesn't mean we don't need to supplement, particularly in Kathy's office, where it tends to be cold on her floor. It's in the back corner, and that's a location where, sometimes she uses supplemental resistance, electrical resistance heater, which I think is a good idea. So this system actually was working better today than I thought. I expected to come in here and it wouldn't be keeping the temperature up in here, but it was. And it wasn't doing a defrost cycle or anything like that. The two units just kept blowing air out continuously. And then Ben came in and he thought it was fine. Of course, he likes it kind of cool anyway. So this brand does seem to work. And the National Energy, Renewable Energy Research Lab or some such, which has an Alaska office, is evaluating the Mr. Cool units, because the advantage to them is that they have a do-it-yourself installation. They have some that are not do-it-yourself, but this line is do-it-yourself. And so it allows a lot of people to install a heat pump at a lot lower cost, because they don't have to hire a refrigeration person. And in fact, I've ordered two for my place, and Jim Mack has ordered one for his. They are smaller units that we're using in him and his house, and me in an older portion of my house and in my wife's library, that are small buildings, and we're using a 12,000 BTU per hour unit that is only 120 volts. So it's a lot of simple, makes things a lot simpler. So we would use these And in these other buildings, as essentially as we're using them here as the primary source of heat for the building, but we would maintain the existing oil-fired heaters or propane heaters in those buildings as backup or for times when it's really cold or something like that. But it could be that like here, even down to 5 degrees or something, those buildings wouldn't need oil heat. Now, the advantage to using them is that it gets us off of using fossil fuels and generating carbon as we heat the buildings. At the calculations I've made have indicated that we probably don't save money compared to oil heat, at least if the I calculated that the break-even point is somewhere at $6 or slightly more for a gallon of heating oil. And so when the heating oil is more than $6, which sometimes it is, I think it is now around that, then we at least break even, or we may come out better on using the heat pump, lower cost. But then again, with the rate increase that we're going to get with the when the new rates are calculated at the end of the existing rate case, when those go into effect, that could shift again because our electric rates will go up. So I can't say that it's cheaper, but it gets us doing what I think is more responsible, that is shifting away from oil heat where we can. So that's the idea of it. If we can get credits for installing them, that's all the better.
And want to move on to the project planning for the purchase of the Salmon River Harbor property?
Oh, okay. I guess that's another one I did. Yeah. I think I've mentioned this before enough times that maybe you're pretty much aware of what we're doing here. Buying the central tract B2 of the harbor and the submerged lands along B2 and B3, so that we would then have proprietary jurisdiction as owners of those lots and of the subtitle out to the middle of the river, just as we do currently for B1 and B3. And since our old CRMA that we manage the harbor with is far out of date and no longer describes the harbor as it is now or covers the operations we have now, we would have to rewrite that CRMA by 2027 anyway. To me, it seems more sensible if we can just buy that property and then we don't have to deal with a CRMA in the future. So, and we would have more freedom to make changes. We could do some things like even commercial operations if we wanted to allow them there that we can't do currently with the state owning it. So that's what that's about. We don't know yet what the price will be until we file an application for it.
So there's a resolution that will be in the general meeting packet to support this. Mm-hmm.
And so we'd have to, once the council approves it, we can go ahead and fill out all the paperwork and do the application and all that. And there's a $400 fee to file the application.
Okay, thank you, Mark. And Denise? Nope. The last, pretty close to the last item would be, is the number 13. We don't have a document and won't, I don't think, but creation of land advisory committee. Could you talk to that, Mike?
Okay. When the whole thing came up, the big brouhaha about HIA possibly taking ownership of our Gustavus Forelands Preserve Lands, there were a lot of people who said, we need to form a committee or something to stay on top of the management of those lands and be more actively involved in them so that we can influence the management of them. And if this sort of thing comes up again, which it very well could be, where TNC thinks they would like to get rid of what's their largest ownership in Alaska of lands, then we would be positioned better for them to transfer it, either transfer it to the city as one option, if that's what we want to do. And so Kathy Strebler was one of the people most interested in having a meeting, and she knew others who were interested. And she worked with Mayor Shelley to organize a sort of an ad hoc working group that met in here, I think it was a week ago Friday. And we talked about the what we wanted to do in the future. There was universal concern about, you know, an interest in being more involved in managing those lands. And there was also mention about related lands, such as the golf course lands, that may have potential to move into a conservation ownership of some kind, and some other tracts that could be that come up occasionally as possibly being added to the preserve lands. So the interest is a little bit broader in than just the preserve lands. The TNC own seven tracks. Well, there are five tracks that they still own. Two of the tracks one and two along the south edge of the Dude Creek Critical Habitat area, went to Fish and Game with conservation easements from TNC and Fish and Wildlife. So there are five tracks that are still managed by TNC, and they've fared well over the last 20 years, but people are concerned about whether that will continue to be sustained in the interest of the public here. So the group decided that they would like to propose that the city have an advisory committee that focuses on that aspect of lands, but not getting into other lands like the gravel pits or land around the fire hall and city hall here, or even the lot across from March Banks that we own, and some of the other city lands would not be issues. This would be conservation lands that the interest would be in. So we have drafted a resolution, but that working group wants to get together and go through it and probably edit it or improve it. I did the draft as based on comments from the meeting, but I'm sure there are a lot of good ideas that other people have. So we will want to modify that. And then when it is in a form that we think we want to recommend to the city, the working group does, then we can recommend that to the mayor, who was in the meeting and was part of it. She can, if she agrees and so forth, bring it to the council for consideration of making a formal advisory committee. And so that's where that is right now. But we're not ready to present, to have a resolution on the table this month. It would probably be next month. Did I cover it all? You did. You were part of it, of course.
Okay. And so let's see. Where are we now? Coffee with council and Madam Clerk, I think this may be up to you to talk about the scheduling.
Yeah, so I reached out to the council via email asking for availability to host, with the idea that, you know, two people would host, even asking for requested co-hosts. I got a few responses. For those I didn't get back to, I will send another email or give a phone call follow-up, but I'm hoping to have it out tomorrow, at least for the next two they're upcoming. And then once we have those hosts, I'll work with those hosts to see where they want to host, and just kind of go from there with details with the posting and notices and whatnot. We've gotten incredibly good feedback from Coffee with Council, and hopefully with you guys taking the time today to answer those questions, Rachel or Kyle will be able to present those answers, as well as will be in the packet and the posting for the general meeting, showing the citizens of Gustavus that council is going to try to have some follow through. Not just are we listening, but now we're going to have at least answers for you, or the best answers we can until we get better. So hopefully that'll keep improving relations between the city and the citizens here.
Okay, thank you, Liesl. And that will, I'll present my report next week. And so we're back at the on the work session agenda. And the last item is celebrating the city of Gustavus 20-year anniversary on April Fool's Day. We talked about, you know, whether to sort of have a little party, or it's also it's a work session day, so we'll be meeting at 6. One of the ideas I had is to list all of the people that have been council members and officers in the 20-year period. I've started a chart back there by my desk, and Lisa and I have talked about this too. Do you have any thoughts about how we can celebrate this event? Go ahead, Janine.
So I think that's a great idea to have the people. And then I'm thinking maybe even highlighting what are our biggest projects, what are our biggest successes, and how has, by being a city, what have we gotten done? And I think, I mean, it's amazing to me how much the city has gotten done. And I think sometimes we forget where we've come from. And so I think it would be really good to highlight the big projects from the past, but also really highlight what we're doing now, because I think we, like, even things like the septic was a huge issue for so many people, and that I think the city needs to, like, make sure we take good credit for the things that we've done. And so I'd like to see it, you know, maybe, I mean, maybe we could all go out with cameras and start taking pictures of the DRC and have pictures, I think, visual, like if you were going to do something, whether it's a slideshow or whether you send stuff in and have it printed on, you know, big pieces of paper, or I don't know, just something that then is, that shows, you know, what we've done. And I think we've, if there's a, you know, list of things that we can take pictures of, if you can brainstorm a list and we can try to, I can go out and take pictures, or other people can too. I think it'd be really fun to have it be a good visual kind of thing.
Yeah, and I don't know how far back we have agendas and minutes for, but and I guess a lot of it will just be talking to our resident historians. That would be Mike. How about I'll take on the chart of people, and would you like to take on the other display, the list of big projects and Kurtz?
Well, I don't think I'm the one who knows it. I'm willing to go out, and if there's current things you want pictures taken of, I'm willing to do that, but I don't have the resources or the knowledge, basically. I think looking at somebody who's been around more, that could perhaps be easier. I see Liesl's got her hand.
So one, you're, as far as agendas and meetings and things, I believe that the archival is only 7 years for those, but I do have a full history of council seats and who held them and for how long, that was, you know, I gained when I took this chair and this role. So I can share that with you, Shelley. Okay. And I don't know, I might be stepping out of place here, but Janine, it might be just somebody as a point of contact for that. And then maybe we could even, I could do Facebook postings of, you know, things that maybe asking other people what they'd want to highlight, or even just a point of contact for other people to reach out to. I don't know if you'd be willing to do that, and maybe you and I could work together and put, you know, finalizing it.
Sure.
I don't know. Just throwing it out there.
Contact, but I certainly am not one who's got all the information.
I clearly don't. I've only been here for 6 months.
I know somebody who's been here a long time.
And Karen Taylor also is a highly knowledgeable an historian. Good. Yes, go ahead, Brian.
Just a point of clarification on this. I'm not sure I understood what shape we're imagining shape or timing we're imagining this actual, like, is this an event that is happening at like the community center, or what's the final vision for what this might?
What do you suggest?
Well, if it's happening on April 1st, I will be working 10 hours and then coming straight to a council meeting. So I'm not going to be able to attend that at all. Mm-hmm. But I think in something at the community center, I mean, it's not necessarily something that the city, well, actually, I don't know if the city played a role in bringing the community center to life, but based on being at their open.
Endowment funds.
Endowment funds mainly, but otherwise it was separate.
Mm. Yeah, then I don't know if that's the most fitting place for it. I mean, it's hard to say if the weather will be nice enough in the Salmon River Park or any city owned property for us to want to try and host an outdoor event. But gosh, I mean, even down at the beach could be, well, yeah, it seems like if we can and we want to host something in person, it would be nice to be able to host it somewhere where it's, you know, a city property or somewhere that's where the city's had a significant project, and we'd be able to, yeah, I don't know. That's, yeah, the library could be a good one too. It depends on how big of a turnout we're expecting, because the library is certainly one of the city's, that's also a city project, was it not? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
It was before the city.
Yeah, it was built.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's pre-city.
Kathy was a...
Yeah, I know you were the driver
on me.
It was the way before the city. We weren't the city until 2004.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Library was about 94, 96, or what was it?
I have to go look. Or 7, 96, 97.
Somewhere.
By the time we got everything wrapped up, something like that, I would have to go look.
Hmm.
But yeah, because I mean,
it took a lot of years just to get the land straightened out so we could have site control. So then we could proceed with, you know, applying for construction grants and writing land use agreements and all of that. Yeah, it was a bit of a chore. We didn't have good support from the school district for a while.
Well, I don't know if that necessarily precludes us from using the library as a location, because it's still something that the city runs to great success, I would say. So
this is a little more spacious here, and we have to be here at 6 anyway.
Yeah,
that's why I was thinking of having something here, but we're looking for an event planner.
But if we could have it outside too, mm-hmm. with the fire and stuff, then we're limited what we can do inside. We're not limited mm-hmm. what we could do outside. Oh.
Yeah. No good.
Fire hall would be another place if it was weather wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
Take the apparatus out and display it out in front. And
mm-hmm. Okay, well, if anybody wants to consider this further, let us know. And does that take us to the end?
I got a quick question. Sure. Mike. While we were talking about this, it occurred to me to ask. We have a way to get the flowers done for our baskets and our planters out there yet? Or how are we going to do that this year, since Jen Landry wasn't going to be available this year?
What are your thoughts? I wasn't familiar with that process. I think you organized it last year, right?
Yeah, or the last couple of years. I'm sure that our city administrator could do a great job with it.
But do you get
a volunteer cast?
Shaking her head.
Well,
if it was up to me, we'd have two baskets out there and call it a day.
I think it really, the flowers really brightened up the community and looked good. We don't do quite the display they do in Juneau, but if we don't have somebody interested, there may be somebody interested. We could. We'll post a notice of see if anybody's interested in growing them, if who has a big enough greenhouse, Jen Landry did last year. Or the other option is to buy them from a provider in town, like we did the year before.
Would you like to take this project on?
No. Well, I've got enough other these road things, and I was hoping somebody else might.
Mm-hmm.
Be willing to take the lead on it this year.
Seeing no hands raised, maybe we can talk about it again next week.
Sure, maybe there's somebody in the public mm-hmm. who would you know, Meadow contributed a lot to it, and there were
Ann Wildman.
Yes, Ann Wildman, and they'll be back probably April sometime.
Mm-hmm.
So they were drivers for it, but there still needs to be somebody in the city who sort of ramrods the purchasing stuff,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that all works. It's not awfully hard, mm-hmm. by any means.
Do you have a list in mind of what you did in the past that you could pass off to someone who, you know, it's kind of nice if there's a checklist. This is the various things that need to be done.
Sure, I could make that up probably. I mean, essentially we had about 14 baskets, I think, because last year, because we hung them on the, you know, like out at the dock on the welcome sign and the one by the airport, and we had them here in the park. We had them on the fire hall. We had them at the library. We had them at the community chest one, I think, there. And so it came up to about, I think, something like 13 or 14 baskets, and then enough flowers to fill the bed out here. And we also had some for them to plant at the library, which I think the reading groups planted along with the librarians.
I can help coordinate that. I mean, I think that we could put it out on the Facebook gardening group and get people to start flowers, and I could help coordinate that.
Good. And there's a suggestion that just arrived by Sticky. Could it be a joint project with the Gustavus Visitors Association?
It could be. What about with the Girl Scouts?
This is a hot
potato. You want to come and lead? Sure.
Okay. So with the Visitor Association is a good idea.
The issue is you have to figure out who's going to maintain them. And you have to buy the right planters, because some of these didn't have holes in the bottom. And when it rained and rained and rained, they flooded and half of them drowned. So I'm just saying there's maintenance and upkeep of them all. And then when they, you know, go to seed and, you know, pick them out, then plucked a whole bunch of them out here so they'd regrow. But there's upkeep.
Sure. Watering.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to go around and water them.
So there's a couple of ways it could be looked at. Like maybe someone would, like, they're going to adopt one area, you know, and so that they, instead of one person becoming in charge of everything, it's like you do these things, or
mm-hmm.
there's different ways to organize it. Is there a budget for it? Like,
good question.
We did last year. In fact, I think we put money in our budget.
And
for it. Yep, says, said, yeah. Yes. So we did. Okay. We did budget it for it for this year.
So yeah. So I mean, I'm willing to take it on, but I'd like to, yeah. And then we can get together and find out more details of what needs to happen and what the budget is, and how we can get flowers. And so if you grow coreopsis, I'll go around and pick them, because I use them to dye with. I would love to see the world with coreopsis flowers growing everywhere. So I think that we could, it would be very, yeah, I'm willing to take this on and can find some helpers.
Thank you. Okay, and that wraps it up. Any additional comments or thoughts before we head out? All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.